At the end of the last lecture, I introduced the idea of basic income as a way of thinking about how we might approach this persistent and difficult problem of poverty in rich countries, and in particular in the United States. We didn't have a lot of time for that. And I'd like to just briefly spend a few minutes at the beginning of this class talking about it a little bit more. It's not that I think this is a practical proposal for the United States in the year 2012. We're hardly at a historic moment where there's any prospect for some fundamental reform in how we deal with our social problems. We are at a political impasse with respect to any really deep structural change, certainly of the sort that I would think would create a better world. But nevertheless, I think the idea of basic income is worth taking very seriously and thinking hard about because of the way it reveals the nature of our existing world and also helps to think through the implications of fundamental change. So just to rehearse what we talked about at the end of the last class, I said that there were three different sorts of ways you could deal with poverty. You could make people's standard of living less dependent upon their income altogether by providing more public goods like education, which you're all partaking in, public goods like recreational facilities. If we expanded those, people who have less income, who are income poor, would be less poor with respect to their standard of living. We would decouple the quality of life from how much money you have. That's one way to deal with poverty, I think a good way. A second way is to decouple somewhat the way people earn their income from the market by having more publicly provided jobs. That was a solution that was quite popular both in the United States and elsewhere until the last 25 or 30 years. The idea that the public sector was a legitimate source of employment, that we had many tasks to do that were best done through public employment, and that public employment could provide good and stable wages to people who in other respects might not be so advantaged in labor markets. That's a second kind of way that you could help alleviate poverty. You could have more public sector jobs that would be jobs appropriate for the skills that people actually have, not for some fantasy of skills they might have. And then there's this third type of solution, which is to at least partially decouple the amount of money you have from how much you earn from your jobs altogether. To decouple how much money you have from how much you earn for jobs. Now, a certain percentage of the population already have their income decoupled from what they can earn. Children of very rich families, their income, how much money they have to deploy in the world, is partially decoupled from how much they can earn through their own jobs. Parents set up trusts. They create an endowment in which part of the standard of living of their children comes from income generated by such an endowment, not generated by whatever effort the children of such families expend. Not all wealthy parents do that. Some wealthy parents feel their kids should just make it on their own. But most wealthy parents want to endow their children with a stream of income that's independent of the effort of their children. In effect, what wealthy parents are doing is giving their children basic income. Right? They're saying, unconditional on how well you do in your own work, unconditional upon your effort, you will have a stream of income that provides you with some kind of basic standard of living. Sometimes parents put conditions. You know, sometimes they don't. It just depends. But a basic income is something we already have for privileged people in the society. And of course, this creates all sorts of possibilities for those fortunate people. I mentioned the idea of internships. I imagine many of you do summer internships. unpaid internships. Many of you, after you graduate, will have the opportunity for interesting internships. Increasingly, large organizations, both corporations and nonprofit foundations, NGOs of various sorts, even government organizations, have unpaid internships for college graduates and sometimes summer internships as a way for people to gain experience, which they can put on their resumes, which makes it easier for them later to get a good job. You have this experience of being an intern in a government office, in a corporation. You all know about this. Well, unpaid internships are great, but you still have to eat. You can't just decide for the summer, I'm not going to eat and I'm not going to sleep in a room, I'm going to just live in my car. You know, you could do that, I suppose. But mostly, people who get unpaid internships have some other source of income. They have a basic income, provided usually by family. My daughter, who's now a quite successful theater director in Philadelphia and New York, she, by the way, called last night when the power went out. She was huddled in her apartment. The power was out. Their basement was flooded. She had a certain woebegone tone of voice, but was soldiering on. At any rate, when she graduated from college, she had an internship as a dramaturg in a small theater in Philadelphia, which she could do because we could provide support for her for the summer. We gave her, in effect, an unconditional basic income grant. Now, the idea of basic income is that everybody should have such a grant. Everybody should have their basic standard of living taken care of, enough to live a kind of no-frills level of living. That's what artists and actors, musicians often live, is this sort of no-frills basic standard of living. Everybody should have unconditionally such a standard of living if the society can afford it. Now, there are two kinds of objections to this idea. One objection is moral. One objection says it's simply immoral to give everybody a standard of living irrespective of their virtues. It should, if you're going to give people money, it has to be conditional on, in particular, their effort. Income that you get from jobs satisfies that condition, right? If you get income from a job, it's conditional upon you doing the work that the job requires. So some people object to this on the grounds that it's simply wrong to give people a basic standard of living, to give people income as an entitlement, to use a word that's become a kind of political dirty word in contemporary politics. So that's one kind of objection. And we could have a big philosophical debate about that, whether it's okay for rich parents to give an unconditional basic income to their kids. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's wrong for us collectively to give everybody a basic income. I think it's a good idea and that it's morally justified. Other people would object to that moral argument. They would say, no, this is simply unacceptable, even if it would work. Let's put aside that issue, okay? I'm not saying that it's unimportant, and I'm not saying that there aren't good arguments against basic income, opposing it on moral grounds, but let's put that particular issue aside and look at the other kind of objection. The other objection is that simply couldn't work. If you gave everybody a basic income, most people would simply stop working. There's a famous article by a defender of basic income, a guy named Philippe Van Parijs. He's a Belgian philosopher, sociologist, very interesting guy. He wrote a quite well-known paper in philosophical circles called Why Surfers Should Be Fed. And he takes the kind of hard case of surfers and arguing why they should get a basic income as well. But all of that is premised on the question, well, would it work? Would most people want to be surfers? If everybody wants to be surfers, a basic income collapses immediately. right? So if everybody wants to be surfers, you can't have a basic income, because as soon as you start giving people that enough money to just basically live on, you no longer have any money to give anybody, because nobody is generating income in the economy, which then gets redistributed in the form of a basic income. So that's one key objection, which isn't a moral objection. This is a pragmatic objection. Basic income is simply impossible. It's a fantasy. Now, that argument depends upon a particular view about how people would respond to having a guaranteed standard of living. Whether this would mean that most people, or at least a sufficient number of people, would withdraw altogether from the economy and would stop engaging in productive activity. So let me just give you the way to approach this question. Let's imagine that we gave everybody in the United States, every legal resident, $1,000 a year. That's a sub-basic income, right? Nobody can live on $1,000 a year. In Alaska, there is a basic income of that character. Every citizen of Alaska gets a couple of $1,000 a year. It's called the Alaska Permanent Fund. It's basically the royalties from Alaskan oil that the Alaskan state government gets. They just redistribute it to its population on a per capita basis. So if you're a family and you've got three kids, so you've got two adults and three kids, five people, each person gets a couple $1,000s a year automatically without doing anything, just by virtue of being a legal resident of Alaska. So that family gets about $10,000 a year as a basic income. That already exists in Alaska. If we gave everybody $1,000 a year, that would not be sufficient for people to withdraw from the labor market, right? So we know that we could do $1,000 a year. If we tried to give everybody $30,000 a year, it's pretty clear that the level of taxation you would need to give every single person $30,000 a year would make the economy immediately collapse. What that means is somewhere between $1,000 a year and 30, somewhere in that range, there is what we could call the maximum sustainable basic income. The maximal sustainable basic income. It's somewhere, I don't know where that level is, but it's somewhere somewhat more than 1,000. It's already more than 1,000 in Alaska. And it's certainly less than 30,000 a year. There's just no way that we could ever afford to guarantee to every person unconditionally $30,000 a year. Somewhere between 1 and 30 is this maximum level. Then the question is that maximum level above the poverty line or below the poverty line? I think there's plenty of good evidence that it's probably above the poverty line. That is, there's plenty of good evidence that people, if they get a windfall that gives them an income above the poverty line, they continue to work. Most people want discretionary income. They want earnings above a basic income. And therefore, most people will continue to work in labor markets or to engage in productive activity in order to generate earnings above that level. But that's a hypothesis. That's a conjecture on my part. It's something that you really can't prove very well. It's kind of hard to do the experiment. There have been some experiments done historically. There are cases where there are what are called guaranteed income experiments. These were done in the 1970s in a few places, where people were randomly given an annual income above the poverty line. There was a big government-sponsored experiment of that sort, funded in the United States in the 1970s, and another one in Canada. So this has happened, that such experiments have been done. Generally, they've shown that the labor market effects are very modest. So whatever empirical evidence we have seems to suggest, probably, that you wouldn't get massive withdrawal of people from the labor market if they were all given a basic income. But if they were all given a basic income, we can imagine all sorts of new opportunities and possibilities would occur. And I discuss a few of these in the book. The simplest is the little example about internships. That's an obvious kind of example. But there's lots of other things. The ability of people to become self-employed and to start their own businesses, whether as individual proprietors or as cooperatives, worker-owned firms. So a group of 10 people who want to get together and form a small business together, jointly. It's much easier if you don't have to produce enough income from your new venture to cover your own basic costs of life. If you have guaranteed outside of your business enterprise your basic standard of living, of food and shelter, if that's guaranteed independently of how successful your business is, it's much easier to start a business. That's, of course, the way many people do start businesses. Again, they have family support to provide them the basic income while they start a business or a cooperative or some other venture. One of the things one would predict if you had an unconditional basic income was a very large increase in small business, both of a cooperative character where people form joint efforts and of an individual effort. And that, I would argue, would add a lot to the dynamism of the economy. So that ironically, if you gave everybody a basic income, the economy becomes more dynamic, I would predict, rather than less dynamic. And above all, in the context of what we were talking about last week, if we gave everybody a basic income, one of our crucial problems would be, at least in its biggest dimensions, solved. That is, no one would live, and particularly no children would live, below the poverty line. And this would be done without stigma, because everybody gets a basic income. Just one final thing, because sometimes there's confusion. When we say everybody gets a basic income, what that means literally, Bill Gates gets a basic income. He gets the $8,000 or $10,000 a year that the basic income would entail. And so would all of you. You would all get basic incomes. But the basic income would be combined with whatever earnings you have to determine what your rate of taxation would be. Bill Gates' taxes would go up by more than the amount of the basic income. So let's just suppose the basic income was $10,000 a year. It's possible that that would be the level for a single, per person. If the basic income was $10,000 a year, a rich person's taxes would go up by way, way more than $10,000 a year. They would not be net recipients of basic income, because you have to pay for basic income, and it would come out of a steeper tax structure. The income tax would have to be increased by the amount of the basic income in order to pay for it. So some people are net recipients and some people are net payers. But there is no bright line between these two. People move back and forth across that barrier. And if you're below the barrier, if you're a net recipient, there's no disincentive for you to earn more money. You don't lose your benefits. The basic income goes to everybody. Just as parents, the basic income of public education goes to their children, and there's no disincentive for parents to earn income just because their children unconditionally receive that benefit, that is, education. Okay, that's the basic structure of this idea. It's not politically feasible. I think it's economically feasible, it's just not politically feasible. And I think it's the kind of transformation that we need to have if this particular aspect of the social problems we face in the United States, persistent poverty, is to be robustly solved. The rising tide lifts all boats solution simply has not shown to be successful with respect to this particular issue. All right. That's the coda from last time. Now on to the topic for today, race in America. This is really a complex issue, understanding how race works. The title of the course, of course, is American Society, How It Really Works. In this part of the class, you might think of this subpart, this subsection, as race, how it really works, race in America. So first, what we have to do is really get clear in our heads what these concepts are. What are we really talking about when we talk about race? What is race, and what is racism? So first, race. Here's a kind of formal definition. Race is a classification of human beings on the basis of culturally defined, biologically transmitted group characteristics. Typically, but not invariably, these are connected to visible attributes like skin color and other physical characteristics. Now, here's the key point here. Race is not a biological category, although it uses biological attributes as the basis for its classification. But it's a culturally constructed, a culturally defined category. In different times and places, racial boundaries are drawn in very different ways. And this is really important to understand, and to understand its deep implications, not to just say, oh yeah, I know that. What does it mean for a person to be called black? What does that classification system mean? We have, in the United States, this very simple racial classification system. There are blacks and whites. The color-coded terms are used, black and white. What does that mean? In Brazil, racial classifications are organized on a kind of continuous spectrum. In the United States, we have what's called a binary racial classification system. You're black if you have any African ancestry. This is what is sometimes referred to because this was the legal expression used in the late 19th century and early 20th century. It's sometimes called the one-drop rule. The one-drop rule. Now, when you think about it, the one-drop rule, if you have any African ancestry, you're classified as black. Let us suppose that we just flipped the one-drop rule. One could imagine a racial order in which if you had any European ancestry, you'd be white. Still binary, so it's still a binary classification system. But we still have blacks and whites, but all it takes to be white is one white ancestor. It's symmetrical. So clearly, if we have a classification system in which having one African ancestor makes you black, you could imagine, as a kind of theoretical possibility, a classification system in which if you had one white ancestor, you'd be white. In such a world, we'd have almost no African Americans in the United States. Virtually all people in the United States, unless they are recent immigrants from Africa. So we do have African immigrants. That's a different case. But anyone who's been an historic African American, whose family has been here for a few hundred years, they can trace their lineage back to the times of slavery. Virtually every African American has some white ancestry. And thus they would be classified as Euro-Americans, not African Americans. We would not have a black president if we had a one-drop rule that was symmetrically one drop of white ancestry, obviously. Barack Obama has a white mother and an African father. And that really shows the arbitrariness and the cultural construction of the classification system itself. There's nothing natural, nothing given in the biology that would lead you to classify people as black and white on the basis of having any African ancestry. It is just as logical to classify everybody as white who has any European ancestry. In the United States, all East Asians are considered in a single racial category, right? So the typical American classification system, it's undergoing some change as immigration from East Asia increases. But traditionally in the United States, Chinese, Japanese, and Vietnamese are all considered East Asians. They used to be referred to as Orientals. That was another term that was used to describe that classification. But in East Asia, Chinese, Japanese, and Vietnamese are considered separate races. They're not one, a single race. They're considered separate races. In the US, in the 19th century, Irish were considered a distinct race. How many of you have Irish ancestry? You must have. Okay, so you were not white. In the 19th century, people of Irish descent were considered separate from whites. And in some places, they were basically grouped together with African Americans as the inferior, subordinate racial category. It's a 20th century phenomenon that the Irish became fully assimilated into the Euro-American classification system. And of course, you all know in Germany, under the Nazis, Jews were considered a distinct race, not merely a religious group or an ethnic group. That was a historically unusual circumstance in which physical characteristics were no longer adequate markers. You couldn't tell a person's race by looking at them. There were plenty of blonde and blue-eyed Jews in Europe because obviously the populations had intermarried over centuries. There was not any kind of pure, whatever that means, racial category that had a strictly biological lineage. So that's the Nazi racial system was quite special in that respect, that it did not rely on outward characteristics. But they indeed regarded Jews as a racial group, not a religious category. You could convert to Catholicism and you'd still be a Jew by the racial classification system. So here's the first point. I've belabored this. I've said it a bunch of different ways because it's a hard point to really get in your bones, to really understand its implications. Race is a culturally created classification system that uses biological traits, to be sure. It takes something that's inherited, something that's passed on through the generations. It takes those traits, but the way it uses them to classify people is not given by the traits themselves. It's given by culture, by society, to serve particular purposes. In the American case, it's pretty easy to understand why we had such a harsh racial classification system around people of African descent. No, it's no great mystery. That racial classification system was bound up with a particular kind of social relationship, slavery. So if you combine race with those social relations, you can see why you want to make a very hard and rigid rule to establish who's in the subordinate category and who's not. Our racial system of classification grew up under the social and cultural context of slavery. We'll talk more about that in a moment. Okay, that's race as a category, as a classification system. By the way, when I say it's a cultural category, that means it's something constructed through the way we create meaning in the world. You know, it's a social and cultural construction. It doesn't mean that it isn't real in the world in a social sense. It really matters how you classify people. There are real consequences for the lives of people by virtue of classifying people one way or another. Sometimes those consequences are huge, sometimes they're small, but there are consequences in how people are classified because it underwrites the different ways that people are treated. And this brings us to the second concept, racism. Racism is a set of beliefs and social practices, so it's both in your head and in your actions, in which culturally defined racial classifications intersect forms of social oppression. So racism is not simply a set of beliefs, although it is that. And it's not simply a set of beliefs and social practices which embody these racial classifications. Rather, racism occurs or exists when you have these racially defined classifications that then intersect and overlap with forms of oppression. By social practices that impose harms on people, disadvantages, and other kinds of harms by virtue of the racial classification system. Racism always involves linking evaluative judgments to these classifications. Inferior, superior, worthy, unworthy, dangerous, not dangerous, honest, dishonest. There's all sorts of evaluative terms. You could extend the list. Hardworking, lazy, etc. What racism does is takes the classification system, links it to these evaluative judgments, and translates it into practices, that is, to the activities which affect the lives of people. I don't think we should pretty this language up. Racism is a form of oppression. It creates real harms in the lives of people. I personally think that it's almost, so this is a conjecture on my part, that it's almost always the case that where you do have a racial classification system that is salient in the lives of people, that it will be connected to a form of oppression. That is, you will never have a racial classification system that is innocent, that has no consequences that are harmful in the lives of people. Now, that I can't prove. That's going way beyond existing data. It's a conjecture on my part that if we classify people on racial terms, that is, classify them on the basis of biological heritage, however we define that, that such classification systems, if they matter to people, you know, I'm not saying you can't just arbitrarily classify people and it doesn't matter, but if it matters, if it has weight, if it shapes identities, if it makes you feel who is like you and who is not like you, so it creates this space of identification, wherever that happens, it will, in fact, be connected to forms of oppression. That's a strong claim, and it may not be right. There may be exceptions. But that's what I intuitively feel is the case, that the dynamic in social institutions of this kind of this set of practices, that dynamic only is sustained when it's connected to advantage and disadvantage, not when it's a purely descriptive mapping of persons. Okay. One other initial introductory remark. I'm not going to focus mainly on this, but I think it's something that's important to keep in mind. I talk about it a little bit at the beginning of the chapter in the book as well. Racism in the United States hurts not only minorities, but it actually hurts most whites as well. Now, this is a little bit of a puzzling thing to say, right? So it's standard to say racism hurts the targets of racism. That's kind of built into the very definition of racism, after all, right? So because racism builds into its very definition the connection between classification systems and oppression. So it's no deep insight to say racism hurts the targets of racism. But there are also important ways in which racism hurts many whites as well. And I think it's important to keep this in mind. It's one of the bases for the idea that overcoming racism is in everyone's interests, or at least almost everyone's interests, not just the interests of the racially subordinated group. And there are two things that I think are important to understand here. The first is that racism reduces social solidarity and weakens the various social movements that occur, the political movements for social change. racism is a classic example of a strategy of rule called divide and conquer. Divide and conquer is a way that elites keep subordinate classes under their control by creating artificial divisions. When European colonialists carved up Africa and created the various colonies, one of the things they did was get a kind of mapping of the tribal landscape and then created deliberately, so this was a matter of deliberate policy, they created divisions between tribes of advantage and disadvantage in order to keep the population divided. One of the horrific examples of that was the practice of the French and the Belgians in Central Africa, the conflict between Tutsi and Hutu in Rwanda, which exploded in a genocidal conflict in the 1990s, had its roots 100 years earlier in the decision to create a privileged class of people on the basis of that tribal division. So Tutsis and Hutus had not been primordial divisions that grounded conflict. It was rather a division of privilege and underprivilege created in the colonial era. And that's why in Rwanda, the Tutsis and Hutus regard their communities as separate races, not tribes. They see them as separate races. And the language of the genocide was a racial language of the subhuman character of the other group. Well, divide and conquer occurs in the United States. I suppose historically the most famous example of how racism destroyed a mass popular movement that was challenging the power and privilege of elites, the most famous historical example of that was the populists in the later decades of the 19th century, particularly in the 1880s and 1890s. There was a radical populist movement that was agrarian-based that challenged the power, particularly of Eastern elites, bankers, railroads, and other corporate interests of the era. The robber barons were challenged by this movement called the populists. And for a period, the populist movement in the United States included both poor white farmers and poor black sharecroppers in the South. There was a period in which it was a united movement, and then it fell apart on racial grounds. And certainly in the South, the transformation of a relatively solidaristic, class-based movement of poor agrarian classes, the collapse of that into a movement of racial hostility is one of the reasons why populism as a broad political movement failed as well. We've also seen this in the North in the use of minority strikebreakers in various strikes as a way of dividing workers who were struggling against their employers. There's interesting research, I won't discuss it in any detail, but there's interesting research which shows that if you compare American cities and you look at how unequal are the wages of black and white workers, this was research done in the 1970s and 80s. I don't know if it's still true, but it was certainly true there. The cities with the biggest difference between white and black wages were the cities where white workers earned the least. That suggests that the racial gap hurts white workers. If white workers were the main beneficiaries of racial discrimination against African-American workers, if that were true, then you'd expect the wages of white workers to be highest in those places where the difference between blacks and whites was biggest. But in fact, that's not the case. And that's consistent with this view that where there's a big difference between blacks and whites, that reflects divide and conquer as a kind of strategy of social division. And it has the effect of lowering white wages as well. Finally, I won't, this is also discussed in the book, I won't discuss it here. Racism weakens support for universal programs. One of the reasons why the United States has a relatively weak welfare state, why we don't have universal health care, for example, why labor law, when it was first passed, exempted agricultural labor, why Social Security, when it first passed in the United States, exempted those occupations which were most heavily filled by African Americans. One of the reasons why we have a less universalistic system in the United States around these sorts of issues is because Southern politicians objected to universal programs because they didn't want programs that would benefit blacks as well as whites. So Southern politicians in the formative years of the American welfare state, where these programs around health and Social Security and employment protection, when these programs were first created, Southern politicians blocked the most universal forms of those programs, specifically on racial grounds. Now, while it's true that racism hurts whites as well as blacks, still, I think it's really important not to let that fact obscure the most fundamental reality of racism, which is, as I said, it's a form of domination that harms the racially oppressed groups. These harms have been a core part of our history. It's not simply a part of our distant past. It's only in the most recent decades that the classical liberal notion of equality of rights, equality before the law, equal opportunity in the market, has been extended to include racial minorities. This is not part of the American tradition. It's not part of our deepest historical tradition to extend these liberal egalitarian rights to minorities. Throughout most of our history, and you know, listen to this, think about it. Throughout most of our history, we've operated on the principle that some people deserve more rights than others, that some people do not deserve, by virtue of their race, equal fundamental rights in terms of equality before the law and equal opportunity in the market. In the original U.S. Constitution, as I hope most of you know, Indians, blacks, and other non-whites were counted as less than full persons. They were not considered full persons in the counting of persons in the Constitution. Slaves were denied virtually all legal protections. There were no laws against whites raping slaves, for example, which is one of the reasons why virtually all African Americans of American ancestry, that is, they've lived here for generations, have Euro-American ancestors in their family trees. Until the 19th century, even killing a slave was officially, legally, in the South, a non-criminal offense. Indeed, in the 18th century, in some places in the South, there were laws that provided public compensations to slave owners who killed their slaves when punishing them. I mean, just think about that. It was considered so okay to kill a slave while punishing them, that is, to punish them so severely that they died, but then you lost the value of that slave, that there was public compensation. The slave owner would be given something from the public treasury to compensate the slave owner for having killed one of his own slaves. You know, it's that was part of our conception of the nature of these institutions and these social categories. Full citizens for African Americans was not even enacted until 1964. So less than half a century ago, full citizenship rights were not enacted. And to really be realistic about it, those citizenship rights were not fully enforced, that is, consistently and systematically enforced, for some time after that. Sometime in the 1970s, the legal forms of discrimination had been destroyed. Native Americans have been massively displaced from their original lands, subjected to murderous repression and marginalization in ways that were perfectly legal. And all of this is not just ancient history. It's actually part of the ongoing reality today. We do not live in a post-racial society. Forms of racial oppression continue, and they create real harms in the world. All right, now what I want to do is a rapid tour of American history to give you the roadmap. So this is a kind of grim tale. There will be some lectures that will come as we proceed, which will have a more cheerful and optimistic character. And there are moments of optimism in this as well. This is one of the grimmer moments of this class. A grim tale of the forms of racism and how they've historically varied in the United States. I distinguish five different forms that racial oppression has taken. These have a sort of historical trajectory to them. Trajectory means the kind of path of development over time. They're not literally one following another, but some of these were more important at certain points of American history than others. These are all discussed in the book, so I'm just tracking the account that's in the book here. And thus, I won't go into a lot of detail. The first form of racism, which started almost from day one with the first European settlers in North America, is genocide. Genocide, the term genocide, is a systematic policy to exterminate a particular category of persons because of their race, religion, ethnicity, or some other characteristic. That's what the word genocide means. It's a systematic policy to exterminate a particular category of persons. In U.S. history, the treatment of Native Americans was often genocidal. It wasn't always genocidal. Sometimes the treatment of Native Americans was simply to displace them. It was what is now called ethnic cleansing. The term ethnic cleansing is a modern term, which as far as I know, that particular term only at least came into common usage in the 1990s. It may have some earlier antecedents. Ethnic cleansing refers to a policy to remove people from where they live in order to create an ethnically homogeneous population on a territory. In the 1990s, ethnic cleansing was part of the dynamics in both Rwanda. Well, Rwanda was more straightforwardly killing everybody, trying to kill a group. In the Balkans, in the former Yugoslavia, there was ethnic cleansing, pushing people out of the territory in which they lived in order to create an ethnically homogeneous population. Ethnic cleansing doesn't mean necessarily genocide, because you'd be happy just for the people to leave. And that's often what happened. The United States, in some contexts, there was ethnic cleansing. In many contexts, there was genocide. The most kind of famous example of ethnic cleansing was the removal of the Cherokees from the southeastern part of the United States during the presidency of Andrew Jackson in the 1830s. The Cherokee story has a particularly tragic quality to it, because the Cherokee Indians of the Southeast in the United States at that time were settled agriculturalists. They were not nomadic. They had villages and farms. They had adopted European clothing. And many had converted to Christianity. Indeed, many Cherokees were slave owners in the South. They had adopted as a strategy assimilation. They thought if they adopted all of the cultural forms of the white southern population, that they would be protected. But their land was valuable. White settlers wanted it, and Andrew Jackson used the U.S. military to displace the Cherokees to the part of the country which is now Oklahoma. That's why these days we think of the Cherokees, if, you know, for those of you who have some sense of their geographical location, we think of them as in Oklahoma. Indeed, that's where the tribal homeland now is located. There are some extraordinary ironies involved in the Cherokee displacement. The Cherokees were slave owners. Their slaves went with them. So you had Cherokees being removed from the southeast, from Georgia and the surrounding areas, moved to Oklahoma with their black slaves. But in contemporary times, as the Cherokees have become a wealthy tribe in Oklahoma because of both oil and casinos, and the descendants of the black slaves that the Cherokees brought with them want to claim tribal membership, right? Because you can imagine, there's now money in being a Cherokee. And there's a really painful social conflict around the definition of Cherokee tribal membership that excludes Cherokees of African American descent. That is, former slaves of Cherokees are not considered Cherokee, even though they were removed with the slave owners. This shows, I think, the deep complexities of racial classification systems. In this case, the classification system around Native American and the classification system around African American come into conflict, and it's a matter of interests rather than any either moral or biological facts of the case which drive the conflict at the present. One other little note about the genocidal moment of American history and how, and its particularly focused form of oppression with respect to Native Americans. Occasionally, land was officially ceded to whites through treaties in the aftermath of military defeat. So one of the things that happened in Wisconsin was Native American bands and tribes were defeated in war. And as part of the treaty, there was a peace treaty in which land was ceded to the United States, and sometimes in exchange for certain kinds of rights. In the Wisconsin and Minnesota cases, some of the rights that were kept by the indigenous people, by the Native Americans, were, for example, the rights for spear fishing. Now, that's become a big, hot, controversial issue, at least it was at Wisconsin. How many of you are from northern Wisconsin, you know, from the areas where there's spear fishing controversy? I think it's quieted down now. In the 10 or 15 years ago, it was a big deal. There were white fishermen who said that this was unfair, that Native Americans were allowed to spearfish, but white Americans were not. That the indigenous people who had treaty rights to spearfish and to catch a certain number of fish, that their rights were not extended to everyone. And depending upon the particular lake, in order to sustain the fishery in the lake, all of the fish that would be caught in a year would go to the Native Americans. The white Americans wouldn't, Euro-Americans, I should say, in this context, simply wouldn't be given any fishing licenses for those lakes. And people objected to this. Well, the thing to remember is that these rights were given to Native Americans in exchange for all the land which they previously occupied. To say that they have no right to it is exactly the same as saying if you have a cottage on a lake that anybody should be able to go in and sit down at your kitchen table, that you have no rights to your cottage. The cottage is a property right. You own it, and by owning it, you have the right to exclude other people from using it. The treaty rights ceded to Native Americans around spearfishing are property rights. They have the right to exclude other people from those right, from that particular kind of property, that is, the right to catch fish in this way. It's not a case of
of unequal rights to different people. These are ordinary property rights, just of a peculiar sort. They apply to fish rather than to land. Well, I said I wasn't going to say much about these. This is why I chronically fall behind in lectures. I both care about these ideas and I just find them super interesting. So my enthusiasm for them sometimes is a little undisciplined, and I undercut the possibility of getting through everything. All right, onward. Genocide was the first historic form of racial oppression. The second, the most well-known, I think, and critical one that has really stamped our entire historical development of slavery. Slavery is a system of social relations in which one person is the private property of another and can be bought and sold on a market. One person is the private property of another and can be bought and sold on the market. U.S. slavery was an extreme form of this. Now, there are lots of slave systems in North and South America that were less extreme than the United States. American slavery allowed, for example, children to be taken from parents and sold, whereas in at least some other places, slave owners could sell their slaves, but they had to sell them as family units. Broadly speaking, when slavery occurred under Catholic as opposed to Protestant religious contexts, basically South American slavery, they regarded families as sacred units. And thus, slaves, in general, families could not be broken up by buying and selling of parts of families. Whereas Protestant slavery basically treated the slaves as subhuman and treated breaking up a family the same way that you would if you had horses, and no one would hesitate to sell off the colts and fill, you know, the offspring of horses to break up the family unit. That was an extreme form of slavery, which was really, if not unique to the United States, I don't know, I'm not an expert on the history of slavery to literally make the claim that this was unique to the U.S., but certainly all the historical and sociological accounts describe American slavery as among the most brutal and extreme forms that occurred. Slavery was not a marginal feature of American society. When you think of the Declaration of Independence, this great document that is our foundational document for the spirit of America, all people are endowed by their Creator with inalienable rights, and among these include the right, the pursuit of what? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Right? These are inalienable rights. That makes us seem like the land of liberal freedoms. But in fact, right from the start, and even the person who wrote those words, right from the start, slavery was a central part of our economy and social structure. Most of the founding fathers, so, you know, the great figures that founded our Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and led the American Revolution, most of the most famous of those figures were slave owners. And the Constitution enshrined slavery as a legitimate form of property. And this was not just a Southern issue. You know, Northerners like to think of slavery as a purely Southern matter, and that the North somehow doesn't have this stain on its historical conscience. That's simply not true. Throughout much of the first part of the 19th century, there were indeed slaves in the North. I think as late as the 1840 census, there were slaves in various Northern states. But more importantly, the economy of the North depended in critical ways on slavery. The North is deeply implicated in slavery, not just the South. In 1860, 13% of the United States population were slaves. In the South, 25% of white families owned slaves. A quarter of all families owned at least one slave. In Mississippi, this number was almost 50%. 49% of white families in Mississippi owned at least one slave. It was not a something restricted to large plantation owners. Many small farmers would have one or two slaves as well in the Deep South. Now, how can a society that claims its identity is liberal freedom, right? How can a society with that kind of foundational belief for its government and the running of its affairs, how can it accommodate slavery? Right? How can you put these two things together? How can you have a society which says that all men, all people are equal, and yet have slavery? Well, you can see that in order for people to comfortably fit these two things together, a constitution based on principles of liberal freedoms plus a brutal form of human bondage, to fit these together, you need an ideology of racial difference, which dehumanizes and degrades people of African descent as inferior and not worthy as full and equal treatment as persons. Racism in its ideological forms as a degradation of people, as a characterization of people as inferior and as not fully human, that kind of ideology is, I think, almost a psychological necessity if you are also going to have, as part of your ideology, a belief in liberal freedom. And this is what I think has anchored the particularly robust and durable forms of racism as a belief system in American history. Why it's been so hard to move beyond it, even though progress has been made. It's because of its combination with deep commitments and real commitments, not phony commitments, to liberal freedom. Those were deep commitments in the American Revolution and in American history. Give me liberty or give me death. People meant that. But how can you mean that and countenance slavery? Well, the only way you can mean that and countenance slavery is if you regard the slaves as not fully human, or in some other way deeply inferior, so that their enslavement can be justified and still be viewed as consistent with an ideology of liberty and freedom. That's the alchemy, if you will, or the poisonous chemistry of American history with respect to these two realities: an egalitarian view of human rights and individual opportunity with a deeply inegalitarian view of a particular segment of our population. Now, slavery, of course, was an economic system. It wasn't just an ideological one. There were constraints on the treatment of slaves by slave owners. After all, they were property, just as most farmers would not mercilessly beat a horse because you don't want to damage the productivity of your horse. There were constraints on how slaves were treated by the sheer fact that they were an important source of wealth. Furthermore, in the course of the 19th century, there were changes in the nature of the environment, the economic environment of slavery, in particular the banning of the importation of slaves, which made slaves even more valuable, and furthermore made the slave plantation as a plantation that produced both crops, cotton, let's say, and produced slaves through the breeding of slaves, using that term because that was the way it was regarded on the plantation. Slaves became increasingly valuable in the course of the 19th century. You know, if you ban slaves, the slave trade, so you can't import them from Africa any longer, then the supply of slaves becomes more limited. The demand for slaves increases as southern agriculture expands westward. And therefore, the price of slaves went up, which gave plantation owners an incentive to take better care of their slaves and to produce more slaves. All of this led to a increasing value of slaves in the course of the 19th century. And indeed, there's some research which shows that the standard of living of your typical slave in the United States, measured by calories consumed per day, was probably a bit better than the typical peasant in Europe of the time. Certainly the typical peasant in the poorer parts of Europe, like Ireland. The average slave consumed more calories per day. And some people have used that fact as a way of saying, see, things weren't so bad in slavery. I think such claims that things weren't so bad is a gross mischaracterization of the nature of the social worlds in which slaves lived and what it means to live under such totalitarian and repressive forms of existence. Slavery ended with the end of the Civil War. We will be celebrating on January 1st, the 150th year of the Emancipation Proclamation. So this will be given a lot of prominence, I think, in the cultural media because of the January 1st, 1863 date of the Emancipation Proclamation during the Civil War. There was hope after the Civil War by certain abolitionists, the most radical of them, that this would that there would be a context in which there would be full assimilation of former slaves into American society, so that the racial caste oppression of slavery would gradually wither away. That hope was dashed after the end of the period that's called Reconstruction, and a new system of social exclusion was created, which I think is best described by the idea of second-class citizenship. Second-class citizenship is a system of giving different categories of people different citizenship rights on the basis of some attribute. Race being a prominent way of doing this. In South Africa, until 1994, whites and Africans and mixed-race people all had differentiated citizenship rights. Apartheid is considered the kind of clearest case of a system which created first-class citizens and second-class citizens as a matter of formal legal rules. In the United States, what was called Jim Crow laws, gave differential rights to blacks and whites, but often it was not quite as explicit as the rules in the in apartheid. So, for example, in the South, there was no law of the form blacks could not vote. Was never that crude. There were attempts at making it that crude. The crudest versions were dropped. The way in which blacks were kept from being able to vote was typically by having a literacy requirement. And then to pass the literacy requirement, you had to pass a test. And the test was given, was extremely hard. You'd have to be able to correctly identify various articles in the Constitution, for example. Very demanding tests. And then the tests were simply given differentially to blacks and whites. Whites would be allowed to pass the test with many mistakes, blacks wouldn't be. So there was absolutely enforced differential application of rights in practice, but there was not, in general, in the Jim Crow era, laws of the form blacks could not vote. Or blacks could not serve on a jury. They just simply were never picked for jury duty. Whites were always, all white juries would typically rule on the guilt or innocence of black defendants. The second-class citizenship in the U.S. South was enforced by a reign of terror. And again, it's important not to sanitize this history. The form of rule in the South, in particular, involved the use of arbitrary terror as a way of keeping a subordinate population in place. This is a chart from the book. It's a chart of lynchings of blacks per year between 1882 and 1964 in the United States. These almost all occurred overwhelmingly in the South. In the North, in places like Wisconsin, there were not Jim Crow laws, but there were still plenty of legalized forms of discrimination in the North. There were all sorts of legal rules to prohibit blacks from living in certain places. So the exclusion of blacks from buying houses in certain neighborhoods, that was legal in the North. Swimming pools and recreational facilities were legally segregated in the North during this period. Employers frequently used blacks as strike breakers in the North. There were many ways then in which racism as a form of practice that was enforced by the state existed in the North as well as the South, even though the Jim Crow laws were much harsher in the South than they were in the North. All right, it's a quarter after. We'll finish. I guess I can say. Unfortunately, because I wanted to give you this lecture on finance, there's no way that I'm going to be able to squeeze it in. So we're back to the original schedule for this week and next week. We'll finish the discussion of race this week and have gender next time. See you Thursday.